antidote to tyranny is knowledge. And acting with courage to defend our most basic rights, life, liberty, and property. Dedicated to the cause of freedom for everyone. Here's Peter Mack.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for tuning in to Liberty News Radio. I'm Peter of the Peter Mack Show. Tonight is November 21st. We're glad you're with us. And my special guest tonight is Stephan Kinsella, and he is a patent attorney and a libertarian author. And I read one of his articles this morning and was so intrigued with it because intellectual property rights are not something that I've thought a great deal about, and I just thought the current state of them was appropriate for those of us who are libertarians or anarchists, that is, people who believe the government shouldn't be involved in our lives at all. And so after having read this article, it really caught me. I thought, wait a minute, this makes a lot of sense. And then Stephan had me listen to or suggested I listen to a speech by a guy at the von Mises Institute, so I did that. So, I mean, it didn't take me very long to think, yeah, this seems to be correct. So in any case, he was willing and gracious enough to come on the air with us tonight. So wanted to have him on and talk about intellectual property rights. And so, Stephan, if you're there, thanks for, again, taking time to come on such short notice.
I'm here and glad to be here. Thanks for asking me to be on, Peter.
Great. Well, the notion that I – or the belief, I should say, that I came with into this discussion, you know, 24 hours ago, let me put it this way. I just assumed that intellectual property rights were like other property rights. In other words, if I write something and copyright it, it becomes mine and others cannot use it without in some way compensating me for that. If I invent something, then that becomes mine. Somebody else cannot invent something too similar, and I realize that's a gray area. But you're a patent attorney, so you've obviously dealt with these kinds of questions. And maybe before we start talking about that, you can just give us maybe a brief synopsis of how you became a libertarian, if that's how you refer to yourself. And
sure.
In particular, I think it's fascinating that you're an attorney because whether it's correct or not, my experience, most attorneys tend to be rather left-leaning. They like the government to settle disputes between two people, and you don't seem to fall in that camp, right?
No, I don't. There are some rare exceptions among attorneys, but I think that's by and large correct. I think attorneys, there are some heroic attorneys out there, but by and large, attorneys tend to be among the worst, I think, in terms of being statists and advocates of the regime.
Right.
Maybe just because they are, you know, part of the system and they're so invested in it and that they have more of an opportunity to sort of be spoon-fed the state's justifications for the laws and to kind of be part of it. I'm not really sure why. But I'm from Louisiana, and I was always a sort of a conservative individualist type, and of course was exposed to Ayn Rand, like so many people, and in high school, and was a pretty strong objectivist-leaning person for a while. Afraid to Read works by Mary Rothbard and others that seem similar to her capitalism because I thought she was she must be correct in denouncing the libertarians, although they seemed very similar to her political views, which made sense to me.
Right.
But eventually I started reading the others too, Basquiat and Hazlitt and Mises and Rothbard and others and Milton Friedman, and you know eventually realized that I was a libertarian, and then realized pretty early on that the logic of the political principles of objectivism condemned not only aggression by private criminals, but also aggression by the state, and that the state is necessarily an aggressive type of entity. So I became an anarchist pretty early on, probably early college, where I was majoring in engineering. And so I was a libertarian for a long time. This is back in, say, the early 80s, mid-80s, so I've been a libertarian for quite some time. I've become probably more Austrian over the years. And I did accept for a long time the basic idea that, like you mentioned earlier, that intellectual property is just another type of property. It's a kind of a strange or bizarre one that no one seems to really understand. This arcane area of law, which Ayn Rand and other libertarians and conservatives and pretty much everyone in the West assumes is a legitimate part of Western property rights. So you sort of just take it for granted, and you know that there's some problems with it, but it's such an arcane area of law, you don't really understand it, and you assume that the experts know what's wrong with it, and maybe it could be tweaked by an expert in an ideal utopia, and when we get there, we can do that someday, and someone will look into it. But but it always bugged me, the idea of IP, because the main justification I read for it was Ayn Rand, and you know she has this overarching principle view of rights in everything else she does. It's not really utilitarian or consequentialist or sort of ad hoc, which is what I liked about it. But when you read her defense of patents, it's sort of like she just happened to take the fact that the American Constitution enshrines patent and copyright as legitimate, and so she had to find a way to justify it. So, for example, Ayn Rand thought, mistakenly, it turns out, she thought that in America we had what's called a first-to-file patent system, which most of the rest of the world does, which is one reason she may think that that's the case, but we are fairly unique in that we have technically a first-to-invent patent system. But she thought we had a first-to-file patent system. So there's this quite a contorted argument in her article for why a first-to-file system is justified. So you can see she bent over backwards to try to justify why the first guy to race to the office gets the right, even though he didn't even invent it first. And, you know, she basically repeated the mainstream logic you'll hear in law school that, you know, we have to give incentives to people, and it's only fair that, you know, if you know that there's this ability to apply for a patent and you don't, you know, you sit on your heels and you don't apply for it, well, you can't blame the other guy for beating you there first, you know, that kind of unprincipled reasoning. And I was actually just reminded the other day of something someone had, I'd written a long time ago, someone had reminded me of, I'm not sure if it's true. It seemed true, and I think I had validation for it. But apparently when Rand was younger and sort of learning about the American system, she actually thought eminent domain was legitimate because it's in the Constitution. So she sort of had this knee-jerk assumption that everything America did was valid because it looked so much better to her than the Russian system she was coming from, I guess. And I think she changed her mind on that later on. But it just shows you that she was sort of just taking for granted what was in the Constitution. But anyway, it never did make a lot of sense to me because he has this contorted argument for why it makes sense that the U.S. government protects patents for about 17 or so years. And, you know, she has this argument, well, it can't be zero, of course, and it can't be infinite because it's really unfair to give rewards to the descendants of the descendants of the descendants of the creator who really didn't have anything to do with it. So she's already right off the bat sort of recognizing it's not like regular property because I can leave my car or my wristwatch to my grandson and his grandson and his grandson, even though they didn't do anything to deserve it either. You know, so she's treating them differently from the bat. So even in law school, I always kind of, this issue nagged at me. And I started practicing law and then moved into patent law because I was an electrical engineer, and this was early 1990s, and that field of law was getting to be hot back then and very popular. So I moved into it. And I liked it at first. It's interesting working with inventors instead of attorneys. So that's one good thing about being a patent attorney. Engineers and inventors are much more normal and real people than lawyers. And the engineers tend to, you know, treat patent attorneys with more sort of respect than they do a regular attorney because they know they have an engineering degree and they're not complete math illiterates and things like that, you know. So it's kind of an enjoyable career as a lawyer. I kept thinking about it, and finally, you know, I've been doing it for a couple of years, and finally I kept trying to find one way after another to justify it, and I was thinking there must be a justification, but finally I tried it the other way. I said, well, wait a second. What if there is no justification? And sort of all these dominoes fell into place when you just think to yourself, well, wait a minute, maybe there's no justification. Maybe it's actually wrong. And then, this makes more sense now with the way property rights are derived and homesteading and the nature of scarcity and the nature of contracts, and everything just falls into place. And especially when you become an anarchist and you realize, well, wait a second, patent and copyright are just big government legislative schemes. And unlike, tort law, for example, or contract law, which you can envision arising and did arise in a sort of decentralized court system in Rome or in England, or could arise in an arbitral or a private system, you can imagine these things happening. You know, two people go to court to settle a dispute, and someone trying to do justice would say, well, you made a contract, you made a promise, you hurt this guy. So then a legal rule is developed that makes sense and is compatible with libertarianism. But these big legislative artificial schemes like...
Okay, Stefan, there's our music letting us know the first break is up. So sorry to cut you off in mid-thought there, but we'll get back in just a minute, folks. So stay with us. You're listening to the Peter Mac Show, and Stefan Kinsella and I will be right back in a couple minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, we're glad you're with us tonight. My special guest is Stefan Kinsella, and he is a patent attorney, and we were just getting into the issue of intellectual property rights, but he has written on a number of subjects that are very interesting to me in terms of freedom and libertarian ideas and so forth, and I would encourage you to take a look at his website, which is Stefan Kinsella. That is Stefan with an A on the end, S-T-E-P-H-A-N. And then Kinsella is KINSELLA.com. And I'll put that on my website, of course, after the show is over so that you can click on that and look at some of his other writings. But back to the issue of intellectual property rights, Stefan, if we could.
Sure, yeah. And feel free to interrupt me if I'm sort of droning on here because I'd be happy to discuss it. But just to kind of lay out an overview, some people who are new to this, like you are and like, a lot of others are sort of find the initiating process into it interesting, but you know, like I said, if you're an anarchist, you know, you realize that these patent and copyright schemes require legislation. I mean, they are
right.
Legislated schemes, and they're sort of artificial rights. They were invented and introduced by legislatively in the last few centuries. And so, if you're an anarchist, it's pretty obvious just from that basis alone that patent and copyright, at least in the forms represented in the statutes, cannot be justified any more than the Americans with Disabilities Act could or the minimum wage type law, which are impossible to conceive arising in a private society.
Right. But if I may just interject
Sure.
here real quick. Yeah, I certainly see that. But and again, having not thought about it much at all until this morning when I read your article, one could still arrive at the position initially that indeed these rights exist. It's just not appropriate for the state to defend them. So all the legislation about them might be illegitimate. But, you know, just as property rights don't go away when the government goes away, it just means we have to look to private sources to protect property rights. And so one could initially, it seems to me, start out saying, well, we still have these rights, but we're going to have to find another way to protect them, you know, when the state goes away.
I think you could,
does that make
you
sense?
Could look at it that way, and I see what you're getting at. I think to the extent I would agree with that, I would view that as there's a sort of moral component with the honesty and attribution, recognizing ownership, giving people credit, and maybe even, you know, supporting people who give you things that you like, you know, sort of like people contribute now to some of these websites and podcasts that they like and things like that.
Right.
But to me, to call it a right, I mean, if you think about how it would have to, what it really means to have a patent or a copyright, and what they have in common is that it's basically, if it's a right, it's a grant by the state or by whatever legal system is enforcing rights that permits you as the holder of that right to basically have a veto over the use by someone else of property that they already own. So you can tell someone, look, you cannot do X, Y, and Z with that paper or with that car that you own. You can't tune your carburetor in this way to get better gas mileage because I thought of it first. Or not even I thought of it first, but because I registered it first with this agency over here and they gave me a piece of paper. And so to call it a right means you have the right to stop someone from using their property as they see fit. And to me, that's at least from at first glance, that's a type of trespass or a type of redistribution of rights to transfer full ownership or part of my ownership of my property to some other guy just because he thought of a way to use his property.
Right, and that's ultimately what sort of brought me around quickly this morning is that, and that, you know, the guy Jim Tucker was making that very point on the audio recording that you had me listen to this morning.
Yeah, Jeff Tucker.
Jeff Tucker, sorry.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, let me ask you. I've listened to some of your shows, and I listened this morning after we contacted each other and listened to the debates with Stephen Molyneux and the Objectivist, and also part of your Montessori thing, because my child is in Montessori, so I thought that was interesting. But I'm not clear on what, I mean, as an anarchist, I would assume you are more of the principal type of libertarian, more than a utilitarian type who sort of approaches things from, you know, let's balance these issues and find out what works best. I mean, I'm assuming that, right? Or is that the assumption?
Oh, yeah, I side with the principal. I mean, I like one thing you said on one of your writing that you had me read this morning that really caught my attention, you know, coming out of the field of math, was the non-aggression principle as opposed to the non-aggression axiom.
Correct.
And that is,
correct,
you know, yeah, private right, our property rights exist first, and that's why it's wrong to aggress against somebody. You're in effect violating their property. So, just to be clear, yeah, I don't promote anything just simply on the basis of, well, this will maximize the greatest good for the greatest number of people. So,
right,
you know, that utilitarian goal or anything. I say, let's look at the principle and see where it goes. And go ahead.
Well, the reason I was asking this, and this interests me, I mean, it's interesting to me what convinces people to sort of start seeing the light on IP. And this is one of the rare fields in my experience where we actually have been making some progress in the last few years. I mean, usually people are pretty set in their views. You know, they're an objectivist or they're an anarchist or they're a minarchist or they're a pro-choice or they're whatever. But, I mean, I think we've seen an increasing movement of libertarians toward the anti-IP position. And, I mean, I've seen it in the last 5 or 10 years a lot, especially in the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Tucker, for example, on the Mises, he writes on Mises Institute, he sees it a lot. Boulder and Levine, who've written on it, do. And so I was kind of curious what made you think about it and what was persuasive to you. And I'm assuming it was because you are a principled type of libertarian. And what makes me think
that... Well, I certainly like to see myself that way, sure.
Well, I mean, not every libertarian is. I mean, some libertarians, you know, say, well, I favor vouchers because I'm in favor of what works. You know, they have this kind of...
Right, right.
...kind of approach to things. But what I was going to say was most people talk about IP and justify it or oppose it on these sort of consequentialist or sort of wealth maximization ideas. That was never... ever my approach, even from the beginning, even in the justification of it. And Rand's approach didn't really explicitly go there. So I was never really focused on, even on the inside as a patent attorney, you know, does it make sense to me that patents stimulate innovation? I mean, to me, it was pretty obvious from the beginning, especially as an Austrian, inheritor of Austrian economics, that you can't really measure these things. So it was always a question of principle for me. And, you know, when you have someone saying, well, you can patent a new carburetor, but you can't patent E equals MC squared, you know, and you can have a copyright on a song, but you can't have IP in a perfume smell. Things like this, it seems arbitrary. And then when you say, well, the patent term is 100 years and the copyright term is 17 years, not 15 and not 28, you start seeing that these are just completely arbitrary lines. And it's sort of, I think to me, that's what makes it start breaking down.
At the initial stage, for somebody would at this point, as you're describing it, it seems to me one would have to say, "Look, we're going to have to be. It's going to have to be all or nothing. If you can patent certain inventions like a carburetor, then it's got to be possible to do, a carburetor. And if you can copyright certain things, then you ought to be able to copyright recipes, like Jeff Tucker was talking about this morning. You can't copyright a recipe. Well, why not? If I can copyright an essay that I write, why can't I copyright a recipe?
Right.
It's my quote-unquote invention of how to put food together. It's got to be all or nothing, it seems to me.
And the judges and the patent attorneys and the Congress critters will give you reasons why, you know, they make these distinctions. But, of course, they're just the standard legislative and status rationales they give for all their arbitrary legislative distinctions in their various laws.
Right.
But, you know, they don't make sense to me. And I think one, in my mind, one breakthrough that made it really make a lot of sense to me was I kept thinking, why do people make this mistake? What is...
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I know.
Okay.
You abruptly stop when you hear the music, and yeah. I understand that. Well, it is the signal that we're at the break, unfortunately. So we're at the bottom of the hour, obviously, here, folks, and we'll be back with Stephan Kinsella in, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in just
sure.
a couple minutes and continue with this very interesting discussion on intellectual property rights. Back here at Liberty News Radio. I am Peter Mack, and we are talking to Stephan Kinsella tonight. He is a patent attorney, an author, a libertarian in the Houston area, and has graciously agreed to come on very short notice tonight and discuss intellectual property rights, what they mean, if anything. He is, as I said, a patent attorney, so he's obviously very knowledgeable in this area. And Stephan, I think, unfortunately, though, when the music pops up, we sort of cut you off, if not in mid-thought.
That's okay.
Mid-sentence,
I understand.
Even. Yeah. So just continue on, and then I've got a couple questions for you in a minute.
Sure. I was just going to say one thing that helped me really see clearly what the crucial flaw of the IP position for the libertarian is that there's sort of a looseness when we talk about where rights come from. And we libertarians are all about, you know, homesteading property and producing things and trading and contracting. And so you will sometimes hear, if you read, people will, when they try to be systematic about this, they will say, you know, there's sort of three ways to create things or to have rights or to have wealth. You know, and one is if you find something unowned, okay, in the wilderness,
right.
You know, in the wild. Homestead, attractive land, or something like that. Find an apple. And the other is just by contracting with each other, you know, the two parties to the contract both benefit from the exchange. So interaction
right.
and exchange. And then the third is when you create something. And so
okay.
there's this idea that there's three ways of having rights. And I think that is the sort of foundation of the principled defense of IP that objectivists and others share. They think of creation as an independent source of rights. And I believe this is a completely fallacious notion. And I believe it's because they are conflating value and wealth with rights. I mean, it is certainly true that if you use innovation and creativity and your intellect to transform things that you own into more valuable shapes, that you are creating wealth. So ideas can be used to increase wealth. There's no doubt about that. But do we need extra property rights for that? And I would say this, that creation is not necessary or sufficient for rights. And you can think of some clear examples for this. I mean, just imagine that you find some metal, some iron ore, and you beat it into a sword. Now, you've created a sword, right?
Right.
You've made the metal more valuable to you. You may be able to sell it or use it. But do you own the sword because you created it, or do you own it because you were... you know, hammering metal that you already owned. I would
right.
say you own it because you already owned the matter or the material that you transformed into the sword. So you don't need to say creation is a source of ownership to give you ownership of that sword. You already own the metal that it's made of. So it's
right.
not really necessary for ownership. And as for sufficiency, imagine that you steal your neighbor's metal and you make it into a sword. Well, you created the sword, but you're not the owner of it. Your neighbor is. He owned
right.
the metal. Or suppose you work for a factory, and they own the metal, and they hire you to make swords.
Right.
Well, again, you don't own what you created because it wasn't your material, and by contract, the owner of the factory owns the sword. So in that case, it shows that creation is not sufficient for ownership. So the fallacy is in viewing creation as an independent source of ownership. It's not. It is clearly an important source of wealth, but it is not a source of ownership or rights to arise. And once you dispel that sort of fallacious notion or that myth, then you don't have to think to yourself, well, I created that poem, or I created that that recipe, or I created that design. Because if you say that creators own things that they create, well, then of course the creator of a poem, who's going to be the owner? Well, the creator is going to be the owner. But poems are not ownable things. You know, that's the whole problem. All these things we talk about property rights applying to and ownership applying to are scarce resources, things that people can have conflict over. And so for these things, like the metal and the sword, et cetera, we come up with rules to avoid conflict, and we assign the ownership to one person. I mean, ideas are not scarce and can be shared. If you come up with a way to toast bread, someone else sees you doing it, they can toast bread as well. They haven't taken your idea from you. So ideas are infinitely reproducible, and we're actually lucky in that they are. Unfortunately, you know, the items in the real world are not infinitely reproducible. So we have to come up with rules, because if I take it from you, then you don't have it anymore. If we were lucky enough to have some kind of magical ability or device to, you know, let's say I look at your nice automobile, and I just, by looking at it, I can blink my eyes and conjure up a copy of that car, it would be beneficial to me, and it would not harm you at all. That would actually be a good thing. But if the advocates of IP almost see the ability to reproduce ideas infinitely with no cost as a bad thing, and that is why that with IP laws, they try to impose an artificial scarcity on them to try to make them more like the material world, which unfortunately does not have infinite reproducibility. So I'll kind of stop those thoughts there and let you go.
Okay, well, let's see. You did allude to some examples with the sword and so forth, but let's take your example previously mentioned, which is the carburetor. Let's say that you have invented a new carburetor, which because of some design that you're able to affect, you know, dramatically increases the mileage that cars can get.
Right.
And I'm a tinker, and I buy one of these carburetors, you know, legitimate action. I can buy one, and I tear it apart, and I look at it, and I go over it and so forth. And I start producing something very, very similar to yours.
Right.
And then I compete against you in the marketplace.
Right.
You have Stefan's carburetor, and suddenly comes along Peter's carburetor.
Right.
Let's take both sides of the issue and kind of go down that road and compare them if we could. And so the advocates of intellectual property would say, well, I stole your idea, and I'm benefiting unjustly from from your creation. You're making money because you have produced a superior carburetor, and all I did was take it apart, learn in effect what you did. Did a little twist here and there, you know, metaphorically, and now I'm competing with you and stealing some of your business. That's the traditional view of intellectual property with respect to inventions, right?
Yes, I think that is at heart what's at the base of it. That's correct.
Okay, and so how do you in this specific instance? Let's take what you've been talking about, you know, in a little more abstract way, and let's pin it down and say why. Why is Peter not violating the rights of Stefan in what he did with what Stefan created in the form of a carburetor?
So I would say that from a libertarian perspective, if you have a clear understanding of individual rights and property rights and even economics, then there are just so many fallacies in that line of reasoning. I mean, I think there's at least 10 that I thought of when you were mentioning. I've forgotten half of them now. But for example, first of all, what you described is the market. I mean, the market is emulation and competition. People emulate each other all the time. They learn things, and that's what competition is. If I erect a new store, you know, let's say I have a grocery store, and I say, let me have wider aisles, which some people do, right? Let me have wider shopping aisles because these people won't ram their carts into each other, and they'll like to shop here better. Well, you know what? You know, the next year or two, all your neighboring competitor shopping supermarkets may start having wider shopping aisles. This is emulation, and they're not violating your rights. And there was a comment you said about you're stealing your business. Well, you don't have a right to your business. Business is the choice of consumers to give you their money. You don't have a right to their money. They have the right to their money to decide where to spend it. Right. So I would say there's no way to objectively distinguish between competition that people approve of, like the grocery stores competing with each other, and the kind of competition you described. I would also say that just as Peter, I think, was the second guy in your example, learned basically from the original inventor. So the original inventor learned from countless other people. He didn't come up with a carburetor on his own. I mean, it's helpful I think the Jeff Tucker talk that you listened to goes into this in good detail. He talks about exploding the myths about some of these renowned creators and innovators in history, such
right.
as Eli Whitney with the cotton gin and the Wright brothers
right.
and I think was it Watt? And the idea is, instead of viewing history as these peaks of these huge intellectual, significant one-of-a-kind inventors who are like
right.
mountains compared to their competitors, really, you know, the cotton gin started in the 400s and there was gradual improvements, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of gradual improvements over the centuries until now. And so if you look at
right.
this sort of rising line of progress, there's tens of thousands of little dots of contributions to this idea, and Eli Whitney was one of them, and he wants to draw a bright red circle around his place on that line and say, stop, you know, now I own this.
Right, right.
And so I would say that, this guy,
right.
the first inventor, is also standing on the shoulders of other people, and there's nothing wrong with learning from other people.
Okay, and I'll respond to that when we come back. I'm playing the devil's advocate here, but want to flesh this out. So we'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back here at the Peter Mac Show, and my special guest, Stefan Kinsella, is on the line with me. He's a patent attorney, and we're discussing the issue of property rights. And prior to the break, I laid out this example where he had invented a new carburetor that dramatically improves gas mileage for any car that it's put on, and I came along and I bought a model of it and took it all apart and tweaked it and came up with my own version, which is only slightly different. And then I'm selling it on the marketplace, and I'm capturing a lot of the business that was formerly his. And advocates of patents and so forth, correct me if I'm wrong, Stefan, would come along and say, well, you sort of stole his idea, and let's assume that you had applied for and actually had been granted a patent. They would come along and say, that Peter stole Stefan's idea by producing this carburetor that's very similar. But one objection, it seems to me, that one can levy at that claim is, well, if I'm understanding you correctly, what degree did I steal? If I didn't take his carburetor apart and I invented one that's new and happens to be very similar to his, is that stealing his idea? I mean, part of the, which you alluded to earlier, I think, on the show is, part of it is the arbitrariness with which one has to make a determination about similarity. Is that part of what goes into a patent?
Absolutely. I mean, that this is yet another problem with the patent system. I mean, from the inside, I can say, in my arguments, I try not to argue from authority, and I don't think I have any special authority as a patent attorney. It just made me think about the issue. In fact, I try not to talk inside baseball and too much because people's eyes glaze over. But on the other hand, you have these people talking about these complicated legislative schemes that they really know little about or get confused. They confuse trademark with copyright back and forth, and they have strong
sure.
opinions on them. And it seems to me
sure.
that, you know, you should know what you're talking about. I do believe that, in a way, the complicated nature of these systems, these legal regimes, allows libertarians to sort of tolerate them. They, like I said earlier, they sort of assume that they're valid, they're part of property rights.
Right.
So let me mention a couple of things here to untangle this, because I think we sometimes need to. Most mainstream advocates of patents would say, in the case you described, there is no violation of rights because there's no patent. Or they would say there's a violation of rights if there is a patent, only if there's a patent, right? So
okay,
they
right.
want to set up a patent system to cover the case you described. For utilitarian reasons, they think that if you do this, it will give people a monopoly profit that will lure them into innovating more, right, or something like that, or disclosing.
Right. I was perhaps a little remiss or not careful enough. Yeah, I didn't state it, but yeah, let's assume that you had in fact applied for and been granted a patent for this
right.
carburetor, and then clearly after that in time, I came along and did what I did.
Right. And the reason I say that is because most modern advocates of IP law would say that if you don't have a patent, what the second guy did is perfectly okay. It's called reverse engineering, and he didn't violate any trade secrets. If you have in your possession a product legally, you can learn from it as you will. That's called reverse engineering, and it's perfectly legal. But what happens is you have these libertarians who have – they try to have a justification for this system, and they'll say, well, the reason why it's okay to have a patent right granted to the first guy, you know, is because, well, X, Y, and Z. And X, Y, and Z will be these sort of ad hoc things they throw out, like they'll say, well, plagiarism is wrong. Well, the second guy's not really necessarily saying he invented it all on his own, so it's not really plagiarism. Or they'll say, well, theft is wrong, copying is wrong. Well, I mean, I will tell you, as a patent attorney, in my experience, I've been called on, and I just posted about this last night because I realize most people don't realize this, because you'll have these defenders of IP saying it's wrong to steal people's ideas, assuming that you copied it. In your example, the second guy copied it. Well, I've been called on dozens and dozens of times, maybe over hundreds of times, to analyze a patent that a company or client has been made aware of that they're worried that their current product may be infringing. They just learned about this patent. They never heard of this patent before. They might not have even heard of the other company before. They invented their product on their own. So in thousands and millions of cases, maybe the predominant amount of cases, the concern of patent infringement has nothing to do with copying. In fact, there is independent invention, and the second company or the company that's worried about patent infringement usually came up with the idea on their own, and then it just so happens that someone else registered something similar two or three or four or five years ago, and now they're in trouble. But they didn't copy it from the other guy. They just weren't the first to the patent office.
Right. Did we lose him, Stefan?
I'm still here.
Okay.
So I was just pausing for... I think I was done with my train of thought here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Okay. Sometimes we have technical glitches with the connections between the three of us, so I was just concerned for a moment.
No, everything's fine. No, so I'm sorry. I thought I had answered your question or addressed your question.
And now I'm concerned because I don't hear you. So, Denny, I'm not sure if we've lost him or if it's simply me that's not hearing him.
Okay. Hello?
I don't hear him.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Well, folks, I'm not sure. We're having a little bit of technical difficulty. This happens occasionally. I apologize, but I am not at this point hearing Stefan. He may be talking, maybe therefore talking over him. So as soon as we get everything worked out, we'll be back on, all three of us, or both of us talking and hopefully not talking over one another. Stefan, can you hear me?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Okay.
Okay, yes. Yeah, I heard you the whole time, and I stopped talking when you couldn't hear me. So I don't know what
happened. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. Okay.
I'm not sure where I stopped talking, but I was...
I'm not sure what I last heard. Okay. Well, anyway, you were talking about the fact that there are these companies that invent something and then they either enlist the aid of a patent attorney or somebody to sort of do this search to make sure they haven't, you know, in a very obviously non-intentional way, stepped on somebody's quote unquote intellectual property rights when they clearly didn't, you know, have any even awareness that such an invention was already patented or already invented by somebody else.
No, so let me give you, like, there's sort of four things patent lawyers do. Number one, they apply for patent applications when someone comes up with a new idea. And sometimes they do that defensively, like I do. I do it just to assemble patents to protect our company. If someone sues us for patent infringement, I can sue them back. But we're trying to make products, for a profit. We're not trying to make money off of our patents. Or there are patent litigators who go to court and they fight these things out. Patent attorneys are also called upon to analyze other people's patents when a company is concerned about them. Now, this could happen either when you want to mimic someone's product that you hear is patented or you see is patented because of a mark on it, and you want to see, am I okay here? Is my competing product going to infringe their patent? And in that case, there maybe is some degree of copying. But in the vast majority of cases that I'm familiar with and that a lot of attorneys deal with, there is no copying at all. There's just you learn of this patent after you've already made your product on your own. You invented it on your own. And so the justification for patents given by proponents of patent law, they liken it to plagiarism or to copying, when, mm-hmm. in fact, patent law does not require you to copy at all for infringement. Mm-hmm. And so if you point this out to a libertarian, they'll say, well, I'm not in favor of that. Well, then I'll say, well, what in the hell are you in favor of? And they'll say, well, I don't know. I'm not an expert. You're the expert. I'm like, well, then, yeah. I mean, I don't know what really legal system that you're in favor of. Every time I point out an obvious unjust problem with patents, you back down and say, well, I'm not in favor of that. But then you can't tell me what the system would look like that you are in favor of. So I don't know where to go with you guys, you know. I mean, this is my frustration with libertarian advocates of patent law and copyright law who really don't know what they're talking about and don't know what they're in favor of.
Right. Okay, just to sort of round this out, we're closing in here on the top of the hour, and to the extent that you can stay on, I want to, you know, explore this a little bit further and also get into the areas of copyright and trademark and plagiarism, because, I mean, they're obviously related, and, you know, lay people like me probably confuse the heck out of those things, and it'd be nice if we could sort of, you know, make the clear distinctions. But in the case of the carburetor, and this is where I am now in terms of my understanding and my belief, is even though I took your carburetor, you know, a carburetor that you invented and I purchased legally, obviously, took it apart, re-engineered it and so forth, did a little tinkering, made it a little better, or at least in convincing you know, the market out there, the public, that it's better, and I'm selling and I'm capturing what was quote-unquote, you know, I mean, what was formerly some of your business, and not in a property rights sense, but just business that you had. Mm-hmm. I am not violating your rights because the metal, the very pieces of matter that I'm using to construct that belong to me.
Correct.
And therefore, I'm not violating your right any more than if I read about carburetors that had been produced, you know, in the last century and came up with my own. Just because it's similar to yours or very similar to yours doesn't mean that I have stolen your idea, because, as you said, the idea itself isn't property. It's only the kind, you know, really matter. Well, maybe not really matter, but in this case, matter that I can have property over. Is that right, or is that close?
I can't believe you came along this morning and are restating it this well. I think that's beautiful. I would say every action we take is informed by knowledge, and the knowledge comes from somewhere. So what's
right,
wrong
okay,
with
and you're making a really good point, but we're not going to hear it. So hold that thought, Stefan, and we'll be back here in a few minutes, folks. Thank you very much. Hold on, and we're going to be back for the second hour. This is great. Okay.